This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 424, was produced on April 18th, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. CommodityContext.com founder and widely followed energy markets analyst Rory Johnston returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss all things crude oil, from fundamentals to geopolitical risks to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. As you can probably tell, I'm still struggling to get my voice back, so Patrick and Nick will be covering the post-game segment this week. Hopefully, we'll be back to the regular format by next week.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. The S&P 500 June futures were down 422 basis points, closing at 5,062. Two back-to-back down weeks as the inevitable market correction gets underway. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 61 basis points, trading to 105.94, continues to trade along its year highs. The May WTI crude oil contract down 385 basis points, trading at 82.89, a sharp correction in the bull advance, but is it a buy on dip? We'll take a closer look at that chart in the postgame. The May RBOB gasoline futures down 288 basis points, trading at 270. The June gold contract up 170 basis points to 2388 as the bull trend continues. Copper up 140 basis points to 434, and uranium up 153 basis points, trading at 89.35. That U.S. 10-year treasury yield up 4 basis points, trading at 458. And the key news to watch next week is the global manufacturing and services PMIs, pending home sales, the Bank of Japan monetary policy statement, and the U.S. core PCE price index. Eric's interview with Rory Johnston is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is CommodityContext.com founder Rory Johnston. Rory, it's great to get you back on the show. It's been too long since we talked about crude oil, which is your specialty. Let's start with the big picture before we dive into the alphabet soup of Middle East and various other geopolitical risk factors. Let's just talk about supply and demand, OPEC's participation, a Chinese economic recovery, and what that means for demand and so forth.
Yeah, so thanks for having me back, Eric. Obviously, this year has been, you know, it took a little while to get started, but has become a very kind of bearish first half of the year. Bullish first half of the year, with prices rising from the kind of mid-70s up towards $90 a barrel Brent. So I think that is, by all intents and purposes, kind of a very strong crude number in this current environment. And that's been driven by kind of developments over the first half of the year, mainly around declines in inventories. So we've had this kind of, you know, realized tightening of the fundamental side of the market. And at the same time as those realized fundamentals or kind of inventory draws have occurred, you've also seen a gradual tightening of the outlook for the rest of the year, mostly on this idea that demand is starting to look pretty, you know, a little bit better than it did a couple months ago. And the fact that I think now the expectation is that OPEC will keep these cuts in place for longer and kind of defend higher prices. So I think that combination of factors has allowed the market, you know, it reflects the market has already tightened and expects a further tightening of the market. So on top of that, as these prices have kind of rallied higher, you've also begun to bring in a lot of speculative and kind of momentum-driven trading that is, you know, further push those prices up. So right now, just to kind of give a complete lay of the land, we have reasonably decent inventory positions or reasonably bullish inventory positions globally, or visible inventories. We have a reasonably tight outlook for the market, assuming that demand doesn't falter, you know, on some broader macro pullback, and OPEC remains disciplined in its cuts. At the same time, you know, right now at around 90, we do have a lot of speculative and or hot money further supporting these prices. So I think on a fundamentals basis, I've been saying that we've been fundamentally supported, but speculatively driven in this rally. And I stand by that. I think that the immediate near-term risk is a kind of a sudden pullback in these prices as that momentum wanes and as those speculative dollars, you know, inevitably begin to take profits. So I see that we could pull back there. But then after that, we're left probably still in the mid-80s on a Brent basis with this kind of fundamental backdrop. So I think that's probably where we're standing. And on top of all of this, as we'll talk about at length, I'm sure, is all of these varied and very, very difficult to quantify and kind of wrap your head around geopolitical challenges from Iran to Russia and everything in between.
Let's just go a little bit deeper on the OPEC side of this. I agree with everything you said. The one thing that occurs to me is when we've discussed these markets in the past, I think what you and I have agreed on is when you go from not just bullish, but uber bullish is when you get a situation where OPEC, it's not a question of what they want to do, but what they can do. So when they're running out of spare capacity, that's when you've got a really critical, you know, potentially explosive upside price situation. I don't think we have that now. It seems to me like, although OPEC is staying disciplined on their cuts, as you said, if they wanted to, if they became concerned that prices were too high, they've got lots of room to release more oil. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. And on a kind of a headline basis, you know, we're nearly, you know, 5 to 6 million barrels a day of cuts currently on the books. Now, that's kind of paper barrels. I think more on a realized basis, you're probably talking more like 3 to 4 million barrels. But that's a lot of supply being held off the market. And just to kind of draw, I think, an important perspective on just how large a support that is, you know, excluding the COVID intervention, which I think we can all agree is a particularly exceptional, non-usual market environment. Excluding COVID, this kind of 3 to 4 million barrels a day of cuts that OPEC is currently holding off the market is the largest cut or the most support that OPEC has been giving the market since the financial crisis in 2008. So we're at kind of 2008 crisis level support for the market. And I think inarguably a much stronger economic environment, you know, while growth may be flagging in some areas, you know, we're certainly not in a global recession and in many areas continue to outperform. So the fact that demand last year grew by more than 2 million barrels a day, which is a really strong year for demand growth in any environment. And in that backdrop, we still have OPEC supporting the market to this degree is, I think, a reason to be cautious. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, at the end or kind of or the mid beginning to mid of 2022, a lot of what helped push us to those really, really high prices was this combination of tight markets and this concern that OPEC was beginning to miss its production targets and it was underproducing what it said it would and it couldn't bring crude back to the market. So I think you're absolutely right. That was the catalyst to really pop us higher then. Now we have lots of different cuts to work through and different tranches of cuts within OPEC. So I think the big question now is, let's say we go in this kind of bullish direction. Let's say everything goes the kind of oil bull's way. Now this question is, at what price does OPEC think that it should begin easing back into the market? And I think when you look historically, I just published on this a piece called OPEC's Price. And when you look at pre-COVID, essentially OPEC cut to support the market in the kind of high 40s to mid 50s a barrel on a Brent basis. Whereas in, you know, this latest cutting cycle that began at the end of 2022, they started cutting at $90 a barrel. So I think you can never fully know exactly what is in the mind of OPEC ministers, but, you know, through the idea of like revealed preference, you can see what they do at what point. So I think at this point, you can at least say they want probably at least $90 a barrel, if not higher. And given that prices don't just, you know, trend in a straight line, they're going to tolerate a good amount of chop to the upside. So I think now you're looking at probably you'd need to get into the low triple digits for a decent period of time before I think OPEC would consider accelerating what is currently their planned next kind of major, you know, off-ramp date, which is the end of June. So absent something that goes, well, you know, $105, $110 a barrel Brent, I don't think they're going to waver on that. I think even if we stick in the low, you know, right where we are right now, 90 to the high 80s, I think there's a chance you could see some of those cuts, if not all of them, extended further through the end of June. So I think at this point, you know, OPEC seems to be in the higher for longer defense game.
How much spare capacity do you think exists worldwide, and what's the breakdown between OPEC and where the other sources are? And just to be clear, I'm not asking what the producers are reporting. I'm asking Rory's opinion on the real numbers.
Yeah, so I think realistically, I think you basically have that kind of 3 to 4 million barrels a day of OPEC current cuts, and that's predominantly held by Saudi Arabia. That's 2 million barrels of that in totality is Saudi. And then I think on top of that, maybe you have, 750 to a million barrels a day of Saudi on top of that, and probably a similar amount of Emirati or UAE crude. Basically, that's it. There's nothing else. That said, I think that that's a lot of crude oil in this current environment. You're talking probably ballpark 5 to 6 million barrels a day of current kind of spare capacity writ large, with some of those being active cuts and some of that being kind of stuff that just wasn't part of these baselines and deals. But like you said, that's a good amount of cushion to the upside. Now, the challenge is, if you think, in prior market environments, it would be crazy to think that we had prices in the 90s and OPEC was still withholding, let's just say for ease, 5 million barrels of spare capacity from the market. That's a lot of market support with prices in the 90s. So I think itself speaks to the fact that we are in this higher price regime. And I think I've really been pressing and kind of reinforcing this point that yes, markets are tight right now, and yes, they are expected to continue to be tight, but that is an artificial tightness. That is a specific discretionary policy choice, most notably by, the Saudi government in Riyadh, to keep this market tight and to keep these prices high. And I think the important thing, the reason why they haven't always done this, because, these countries derive the vast bulk of their income and everything from crude oil. So you would think they always would want really, really high prices. But historically, there have always been this, a variety of pressures withholding them back. Most notably, high prices incentivize additional non-OPEC supply growth. So last year, when they first embarked upon this kind of higher price defense, everyone was really sure that the pace of U.S. shale growth had slowed, that we were between the supply chain bottlenecks and technical difficulties we saw in 2022 and promises and commitments of a return to cash flow discipline and a kind of a return of capital to shareholders after a disastrous decade of shale overspending. OPEC thought, and specifically Saudi Arabia thought, that they could get away with prices at those high levels and not see a massive outperformance of U.S. shale production. But, essentially looking at last year's numbers, where the forecast began the year and where they ended up coming in, you're looking at upwards of a 50% to almost a doubling of initial expectation for last year's U.S. shale growth, which was in the ballpark of 1.5, 1.6 million barrels a day of total liquids out of the United States. That's a massive, massive year of growth. This year, the oil bulls have kind of been saying that, don't worry about 2023. It was a flash in the pan. It was privates kind of trying to juice their acreage to look more attractive for, buyouts, et cetera, et cetera. And, at this point, it seems like OPEC is kind of believing that. And the EIA's latest outlooks for U.S. crude production dropped from last year's insanely high, 1.6 to something more like 300,000 barrels a day. So an 80% reduction in the pace of U.S. shale growth. That, I think, is one of the most important things for continued compliance and kind of unity of OPEC, is that we can maintain these high prices and not see a return to gangbusters growth in the United States. Because if you do, then I think you begin to increase the risk of a disorderly collapse of the production deal, because people will begin to cheat, and there's a feeling, particularly in Saudi, that you would need to fight for market share, and that $90 a barrel isn't sustainable. So I think that's this kind of near term worry. And then across the broader, I think the single most important backdrop is demand. How much will demand grow this year? There's right now about 1 million barrels a day of difference, almost double, between the IEA's latest demand outlook for the year for 2024, which is about 1.2 million barrels a day, and OPEC's 2.2 million barrels a day. That delta is essentially entirely slack for OPEC. If you only get 1.2 million barrels a day of growth, it's really hard to see how OPEC is going to materially ease those production cuts this year. But if you get 2.2, well, then we can probably wind off most of this latest cut and kind of be on this path to kind of normalization.
There was another development out of Riyadh, which in my opinion was underreported on, which is that for years and years, the Saudi production capacity was reported at 12 million barrels per day to increase to 13 million barrels per day with additional investment. And then Riyadh announced, we've changed our mind. We've decided not to make that additional investment. So we're going to stay at 12 million barrels a day and not increase it. And it was a little bit ambiguously worded, but
but the way it came across to me, it sounded like they were making a permanent announcement, like we are never going to increase beyond 12 million barrels a day, regardless of what the market does. Do you agree with that interpretation? And if so, is it significant in terms of, you know, it sounds to me like the Saudis are really following through on what they've said, which is diversifying their business activities beyond petroleum and not necessarily focusing only on the oil market as their national revenue source. If we did see increasing prices, do you think that Saudi stays at their current production capacity? Or do you think they'd make that additional investment to try to get up to, you know, another million barrels a day beyond whatever they have now?
So I agree with you that the delay or the announced kind of canceling of these expansion plans was very significant. I don't know if I see it as a permanent state. I think there was, I can't remember the exact quote, but there was a quote from a Saudi government official that basically said, I think it was the energy minister who said, this isn't necessarily permanent. Like if market conditions change, we can go that direction. But I think it's going to take a lot to get them to kind of restart those plans, I think. And to this point that I was saying earlier about the scale of current cuts, it makes sense that if you have, you know, Saudi alone probably has 3+ million barrels a day of spare capacity right now. Why would you invest in expanding that capacity in this climate where you don't know what's coming around next year? And I think what everyone's learned in the oil market right now is that, you know, you really don't know what's coming next year. Each year has been a complete curveball in this kind of, you know, volatile environment. So I think it makes total sense that they're not just going to kind of add to that pool of spare capacity. But I think it also does kind of say that, like, they don't expect to see a major difference, or they don't expect to see major need for that spare capacity in the immediate term. So, you know, you can read it in two ways. You can either read it as bullish to say, oh, well, look, you know, Saudi isn't going to come to the market's support and it's going to kind of keep these prices tighter for longer. And on the bearish side, you can kind of say, well, look, it's, you know, this is Saudi recognizing or acknowledging that you probably won't need Saudi supply to that degree. And I think it's Saudi would probably argue it's the bullish interpretation, but I've seen lots of kind of people taking the other view as well.
One last question on the fundamentals before we dive into the geopolitical conflicts. It's always appeared to me that the big picture of this oil market is we're in a pretty stable condition until the U.S. shale plays have played out and there's no longer capacity to make up for declines in the rest of the world by growing the U.S. shale patch. Are we starting to get there? Because it seems to me like, you know, before the pandemic, we peaked out at 13.3 million barrels per day on the weekly U.S. EIA data reports. We got up to that same 13.3 million barrel per day peak post-pandemic. Now it's sold off by a couple hundred thousand barrels just to 13.1. So it's not like it's in a deep retreat, but it's not increased beyond that level either. Is that going to be the peak? Do we have capacity for U.S. shale to grow significantly beyond where it is?
So I think you can. I think it's going to require prices to remain at these higher levels for a little bit while longer. The one caution I would make is that I typically don't look at the weekly production numbers. And I actually wrote a piece specifically on this kind of debate between weekly and monthly production numbers. And the weekly numbers are more or less the EIA's almost interpolation, not even a forecast per se, of their latest kind of monthly numbers. And that creates a lot of confusion. And I encourage everyone to read that piece because I think it's a really interesting kind of technical and statistical parsing of those two data series. And I think the weekly one gets a lot more attention, whereas actually there's a lot less information there. But, you know, this is just me being wonky and pedantic here. But to answer your core question, I do think that production hit a slightly higher number. And again, from the monthly data, you hit a peak of 13 million barrels a day of crude production in November of 2019. And you kind of hit this new peak of just around 13.3, which is, you know, again, dovetailing with the weekly numbers in December of this past year. Then you had the massive winter storm effects that brought us lower in January and likely February as well. And now we're kind of crawling back up. And what I thought was really interesting is when you look at the EIA's latest STIO outlook for crude oil production, it takes until like end of the summer for us to in that forecast to get back to those previous high levels. I don't think that U.S. shale is tapped out yet. I think that what we have seen is obviously an increasing cost sensitivity in the patch. You've seen, even in the past 3 years, the Dallas Federal Reserve publishes its own kind of cost estimates based on surveys with its kind of member companies. And those estimates show just baseline a $15 average increase in cost of production across all the major plays. So I think that itself, I think, speaks to this kind of generally higher price sensitivity, or at least higher price benchmark and threshold, which I think also helps support what I was saying earlier about OPEC feeling a little bit more comfortable with these high prices. So clearly we're not seeing a boom in drilling and activity right now, but I think you continue to see increased productivity, and that I think was the surprise last year. So I don't think that we are going, I do not see the peak behind us. I think the peak of U.S. production on a crude overall basis, and even in the Permian Basin specifically, will continue to rise, particularly if we see prices this high or higher for a prolonged period of time. The other thing I will say is I do think it's important also on the non-U.S., non-OPEC, the rest of it. And there you really have three countries that always come up. You have Canada, where I'm at, so yeah, Canada, then Guyana and Brazil. Those countries, each of them, Canada's probably, you know, this year could add, you know, 150 to 250,000 barrels a day on both, you know, wildfire base effects of last year and the startup of TMX, which is really exciting, Canada's first kind of quasi new pipeline in forever. So that will allow some new crude to come to market. Guyana, you're probably going to have an average growth of something in the ballpark of 150 to 200,000 barrels a day each year, kind of going forward between now and essentially the end of the decade. And then Brazil, probably 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day, should Lula not completely mess up Petrobras's trajectory. That, I think, you know, just those three countries together, you're looking at probably ballpark, what is that, 600,000 to 700,000 barrels a day. That's a decent chunk of crude production that is far less price sensitive than U.S. shale. These are much longer lead time projects with generally, at least in Guyana and Brazil's cases, lower cost breakevens. So even if we had prices that weren't super supportive of U.S. shale, you still have the rest of that non-OPEC supply that OPEC kind of needs to contend with. So I think that's in particular why getting demand growth kind of, you know, higher than the IEA's current expected 1.2 million barrels a day. Even if you cut the United States out completely, you leave it flat forever, you know, that still takes up more than half or half or more of that demand growth just from those structural non-OPEC, non-US growth centers. So that's why you really need to get like to 1.5 to 2 for OPEC to begin to kind of feel like it has the room to kind of more flexibly begin easing these cuts while maintaining a tight market. Otherwise, I think they're going to keep remaining on this back foot of they might begin to ease, but then, you know, demand slows and it cuts them off. So I think that's, you know, well, U.S. supply response is really important. I still think the most important thing for OPEC is essentially who wins the demand debate for this year. Is it a low growth kind of IEA, or is it a high growth OPEC? And I think the most ironic factor here is that there were a bunch of quotes of Saudi Aramco's own expectation of demand growth this year, and it was at like 1.5, 1.6. So it's really fascinating to me that that's kind of Aramco's in the middle of those two and isn't closer to OPEC. Although you have seen a lot of people coming in with really bullish forecasts. I think most recently the FT had a quote from Vitol, the world's largest independent oil trading company, that was seeing demand growth at 1.9 million barrels a day. So if we have a near 2 million barrel a day demand growth market again this year, I don't see really any situation where it's not continuing to be bullish unless U.S. shale completely does an about face and rockets higher.
And again, that piece on monthly versus weekly production figures is available at commoditycontext.com. Rory, let's move on to the big elephant in the room, which is, of course, the geopolitical conflicts. Let's start with Iran and the Middle East.
The first thing I'll just say is it's always really hard. Everyone talks about, you know, how much geopolitical risk is in the price of oil right now. And it's important to note that, like, how geopolitical risk would manifest in price formation in the first place, because it doesn't happen in a vacuum. It always has to be through buying and selling of either physical or financial crude contracts. So you have two ways of doing it. Either you can have speculative participants that drive the price up on an expectation that prices will rise because of, let's say, the conflict continuing to spiral out of control, or you have physical players that, you know, in the literature, they talk about, quote, precautionary demand, which is essentially front loading purchases for fear that you're not going to be able to get even your contractually obligated barrels down the road because of some disruption. Now, the challenge here, and I think that the challenge for the market since the horrific October 7th attacks in Israel, has been trying to figure out exactly what the vector is for a spiral from an Israeli-centric crisis at the moment towards the broader oil market, which means essentially you would either need to impact Iran, which is where we will get in a second, or kind of something more broadly with, you know, broader regional instability and Saudi getting involved somehow. Because obviously Israel itself and Gaza in particular does not have any oil or petroleum industry to speak of. So when we think about Iran, I think there's two main questions. One, could there be some direct impact to Iranian crude or refining production facilities or export facilities? Or could Iran take the terrible you use the nuclear option here, because that's a very specific thing in Iran. But I think the most dramatic action, which would be the classic shuttering of the Strait of Hormuz. I think most analysts you speak with these days discount the probability or even possibility of a straight up closure of the Strait of Hormuz, because it would just be the ultimate kind of self-defeat of Iran, because Iran obviously depends on that passage for a huge amount of its own exports, most of which is going to China. So obviously China would be very displeased with a closure of the Strait as well as it would prompt obvious and ferocious pushback from other Gulf neighbors, Iraq, Kuwait, UAE, and Saudi Arabia, which all ship various, huge amounts of product through that area as well. So I think that would be the ultimate catastrophic thing. And because it's always a 1% probability event, closure of the Strait of Hormuz for any durable period of time would push crude prices not just past 100, but past 200. It's just such a small probability that I don't think it's, within the realm of even near the base guys. I think more recently, after these attacks, and we're recording this on April 16th, Iran just launched the attacks against Israel, an unprecedented attack. And I think what's fascinating is that it is both unprecedented, but I think depending on who you're speaking with, seemed like it wasn't designed to deal kind of maximum damage. So we'll parse that again a little bit more in a second, but just again, speaking about the direct impact of the oil market. So now if Israel strikes back after this latest Iranian strike, maybe Israel targets Iranian oil facilities, and then that kind of reduces Iranian exports in some ways. Or maybe the U.S. government begins to re-ratchet its own kind of sanctions enforcement against Iran. But I think, so those are the main questions in this immediate term, is essentially what's happening with Iranian crude. And so far, we really haven't seen Iranian crude kind of do much over the past couple of months. It's been pretty stable in the ballpark of things.
It seems to me like the really big determinant there is going to be U.S. participation, and particularly the degree to which the Biden administration is willing to continue unconditional support of Israel's desires. Because I think it's just very clear, because they said so, that Israel would like to make a very, very large-scale retaliation against Iran for the attacks that occurred over the weekend. For the first time, really, since October 7th, Biden put his foot down this weekend and said no to Netanyahu. We're not going to support you in further escalating this. We don't want to get into outright war with Iran. It seems to me like, the question is, okay, what happens next? Does Israel push back? Is there political lobbying trying to get support from the United States to support a larger retaliation that does continue to escalate this? Or does Biden continue to stay on course? Do you agree that that's what's important here? If not, why not? And if you do agree, how do you see it playing out?
I think you're right. I think that Israel and many different factions within Israel want a very strong retaliatory response. I think, again, I was saying earlier that this direct assault against Israel is itself unprecedented from Iran. And in many different quotes I've seen from various Israeli policymakers have kind of emphasized that their response also needs to be unprecedented in a way. There needs to be a similar degree of shock. But then I think you're right. I think that virtually all governments around the world have really been pressuring the Netanyahu government not to overreact, but not even to just not to escalate this further. So whatever the options that are being discussed, and maybe this compromises that maybe the United States does help provide support in some kind of more limited strike. But I agree that, absent U.S. support, it seems unlikely that Israel would do something dramatic. Now, the risk, of course, is that Netanyahu calls Biden's bluff and does something anyways and kind of thinks, well, if things really blow back, you know, obviously Washington's still going to have our back. So I think I'm worried about the degree, the possibility that even with all of that in place, we still do get something further escalatory in terms of response from Iran here. Sorry, from Israel here.
Rory, let's move on to the other geopolitical conflicts, Ukraine and Russia, obviously being the big ones.
You know, here this big question is, after a very long time, and obviously we're now going on, you know, 2 full years of the Russia-Ukraine war, over that period, there have been various fits and starts of presumed, you know, energy impacts from the initial assumption back at the very beginning, the forecast that shocked the market when the IEA called that Russia was going to lose 3 million barrels a day of production, which had ended up not happening. Now, from that moment, we really haven't seen huge disruptions emanating from Russia. It's actually been shockingly resilient, considering the variety of forces kind of arranged against it in terms of trying to maintain these flows. So Russia has been maintaining production really, really well until the last couple months. And at the beginning of the year, even it really picked up at mid-March. Ukraine dramatically increased its attacks against Russian, particularly refineries, but broader kind of petroleum-related assets from oil depots and shipments, et cetera. So this has been deeply unpopular in Washington. Obviously, the overall U.S. view through the entirety of this conflict, and to the point that that was the entire initial impetus behind the creation of the price cap, was to maintain pressure on Moscow without actually physically removing Russian barrels from the market. So now there's this strong concern that Ukraine is essentially taking matters into its own hands. Obviously, there has been tied up in U.S. Congress in terms of the next Ukrainian aid package. So they feel like, you know, if you're not going to directly assist us here, we're going to have to do things on our own. And they've been essentially aiming their own drone forces at a variety of of Russian refineries, which, from the perspective of warfare and particularly this war, are very, very attractive targets. They're large, they're stationary, they're hard to defend, they're very explosive, and they're very important to Moscow's war effort, both in terms of direct fuel contributions to the front lines, but in addition to obviously a massive cash cow and kind of financial support for the war. So I think this has two major effects on the market. One, which is obviously since mid-2020, the world has been in varying states in refining market crises. Crack spreads for both diesel and gasoline, while they're down considerably from 2022, still remain structurally higher than they would at this time of the year in any kind of pre-COVID period. So refined markets are still reasonably tight. When you begin losing upwards of, and depending on current state, it's hard to track exactly which Russian refineries are back online and have gotten bombed again. You know, you're looking at upwards of 13, 14% of Russian refinery capacity has been taken offline by these attacks. So that's a huge, you're talking hundreds of thousands of barrels of gasoline and diesel. Russia exports about a million barrels of diesel a day, you know, in a normal year. So we've probably taken a chunk out of that. And that was a middle distillate market that was already pretty tight. And obviously, recently, Russia had actually banned the export of gasoline because of domestic shortages. So now not only do they not probably have enough to export the measly amount of about 100,000 barrels a day of gasoline that they were exporting prior, they may actually now be shifting into the position of a net gasoline importer, which again further tightens those global seaborne barrels. So that's the refined product market. On the other side, and obviously most of the real way this has been felt so far has actually been in the crude market. And I think it's strange because in some ways the loss of refineries should actually be bearish for crude oil and bullish for cracks or for refined products. But in this, the market has actually been taking far more concern on the crude side. And I think there's a couple ways of squaring that. The most notable one is the concern that Ukraine is not going to stop here. You know, in addition to hitting these big, juicy refineries, Russia also has a bunch of very stationary crude export terminals that it could target. It has thus far not targeted those. So I think that at least thus far, we haven't seen that escalation. But that risk is always there. And I think that's definitely what helped push prices higher initially. The more structural thing that this could do, and the reason you have begun to see some reductions in the overall export of Russian liquids, because, you know, the other thing is that, well, let's say these refineries get knocked down. Well, why doesn't Russia just export the crude? The challenge is that many of these refineries were kind of the end of the road for various pipelines in Russia. And you don't have infinite flexibility. Obviously, Russia has already had to considerably rejigger its crude flows because so much had previously been going to Western Europe and Eastern Europe. So those have already been switched. So you don't have a lot of flex in the Russian pipeline system. So a lot of those barrels are kind of getting trapped in and around their production regions. So you've seen this kind of pressure to begin cutting back on crude production. And what's really interesting, I think one of the most notable ways that you can begin to see, in my humble opinion, the realization, the kind of severity of these attacks on Russia's capacity to produce crude oil is after all of these attacks started ramping up, all of a sudden, Moscow, talking with its OPEC allies and through OPEC Plus, kind of offered, well, actually, we've been doing these weird export cuts that no one really believes in and everyone just kind of ignores. But maybe we should transition them to production cuts instead. And we'll ramp that up over the next couple of months. But it, you know, to me, it seems like Russia is not the type of actor to do any of this out of a sense of altruism or kind of camaraderie with its OPEC Plus brethren. Obviously, prior to this, it had actually been kind of weaseling its way with these export cuts and everything else. So I think the fact that it all of a sudden, out of the goodness of its own heart, decided that actually we will deepen these production cuts now as part of this OPEC Plus deal, for me was actually the kind of evidence or kind of hint that Russia's capacity to produce crude was also getting hurt. Now, we're still nowhere near the initial 3 million barrel a day production loss that that the IEA called for back in 2022. We're still within kind of a broader norm of Russian production. But I think you're beginning to finally start to see that pressure ramp up. Whereas for a while, it had seemed like Russia was doing exceptionally well. And I think this is the first sign that Ukraine has a capacity to actually cause more economic harm than they had been previously.
Our longtime listeners already know, Rory, that any oil market interview is not a Rory Johnston oil market interview until we've discussed the good, the bad, and the SPR. So let's talk about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve next. I have to admit that I am not extremely well informed on some of this, but I have lots of questions for you, because when I saw the Biden administration announce that they had begun refilling the SPR at the maximum possible rate, immediately I was skeptical and I thought, okay, what's the game being played here? Because they were able to draw it down at the rate of 1 million barrels a day. All of a sudden, there's supposedly a technical limitation which says the maximum rate at which it can be refilled is only 100,000 barrels a day. So I'd like to understand what the reason is for that. When I saw that, the immediate thought I had is, okay, what they're doing is they're paving the way to reverse course. In other words, before the election, I bet that Biden is going to draw the SPR down again. And the only way to politically have cover to do that is if he can say retrospectively, well, but look, we drew it down before and then we were refilling it as fast as we could. But it's those stinking Iranians that started this conflict that forced us to draw it down again. We're just responding to the market. Why is it, first of all, that they can only refill it at the rate of 100,000 barrels a day? And is this political or are there good reasons that we've taken this course?
So I would agree and disagree with certain parts of that. I think that obviously at this stage, we can all acknowledge that the SPR is political. That's part of its challenge, is that I wish it could be this completely separate organ, something like the Federal Reserve that could have complete independence. But no, you still do. It can only really operate on the direction of the president, and it can really only be funded by Congress. So it still is caught in this kind of politics constantly. So I think that's a never steady kind of, truth of the SPR. But I think what we've seen year to date. So basically, the SPR bottomed out, last year, and has been kind of beginning to crawl higher as DOE has, or U.S. Department of Energy has been trying these kind of fixed forward contracts. And I've written a lot about this back over the past 2 years, essentially arguing that DOE should take advantage of a highly backwardated crude curve and buy these barrels forward and help support kind of the forward pricing, which again, in turn helps U.S. producers, which look further down the curve to kind of get and hedge their barrels. So that was the kind of argument. I think what we have seen is that they've added essentially, call it 30 to 40 million barrels a day, depending on where your benchmark get from, in these fixed forward purchases. And over the past couple months, they've been doing it at the pace of 3 million barrels a day a month, or roughly 100,000 barrels a day. That, to my knowledge, is not the peak. It's not the peak refill capacity. My presumption on that, and kind of what I understood technically, was it was probably closer to kind of 300, maybe 400,000 barrels a day. But it definitely isn't as large as you had the capacity to draw it down. And that makes sense to a degree. I think when you think about how the SPR was designed, it was designed to kind of build up slowly and then release all at once in a big crisis. So it makes sense that you have more drawdown capacity than refill capacity. But I do think that it probably isn't entirely correct that that's the fastest they could. I think that's the fastest they wanted to. And I think, again, beyond the technical capacity of the caverns and the SPR and the pumps and everything in between, you also have, I think, the capacity of the Department of Energy itself. It has never tried to refill the SPR like this. It's still trying to figure out these contracts. I wrote a lot over the past kind of 18 months about all these new contract details that they were trying out and these solicitations for how to do this in a way that got them a good price and got them kind of some of the other policy upside they wanted, which is, again, trying to lift the back of the curve. So I think they've been reasonably successful on that, and they've learned over time. The challenge, I think, is that the comms and the communications around the SPR, I think, is the weakest part of the entire administration's approach to this. And I say that because I think that over various points, they've made a bunch of unforced errors, none of which were, you know, operational, and all of which were related to communications. I think, you know, the initial way that it was announced as kind of this, like, almost a challenge to OPEC, I think really alienated OPEC in a way that was very unproductive and made them see the SPR as this, like, strategic challenge rather than, I think, what it should be viewed as, which is an additional help. Because, again, like we were talking about, that initially part of the reason that people were concerned in 2022 was that OPEC didn't seem like it could keep up with its own production commitments. That was a perfect time to kind of add on to OPEC with the SPR. It didn't need to be adversarial, but regardless, you know, they still did. And I think to this point you were making about them saying it's the fastest they can possibly do it, I think, again, that's probably overstating the case. And they've been a lot more concerned about how it all sounds rather than, I think, the actual best optimal market impact of the SPR, which has always been more my concern. I think in that case, they should be clearer with things. I think they always try and obfuscate some of the details to make it seem as good as possible. But in the process, I think anyone that's trying to follow this, one, it's difficult to follow. And two, I think people that are following this in a more cursory manner kind of get confused because, like, for instance, the Secretary of Energy had said that until they had paused their repurchases with these latest price hike, that they were going to refill the SPR entirely by the end of this year. And that is both true and really, really not true for obvious reasons. Obviously, they were not going to refill it back to the, you know, the full 200 plus million barrels that they had drawn down. But rather, what the subtext there was that even before the SPR release in 2022, there were all of these congressionally mandated sales out of the SPR. They were going to structurally draw that thing down anyways. And part of what they got out of the big release in 2022 was that they could basically count that all as these congressionally mandated releases. So what she was really saying when she said we're going to get back to full is we're going to get back to the point that we would have been if, you know, Russia-Ukraine never happened, if the emergency drawdown never happened, and we just were drawing down those congressionally mandated sales. So I think that's, like, it's a fair point to make. I think it's a technical point to make, but it's a very, very bad comms point to make because everyone's like, obviously, that's not true. Obviously, you're not going to put 200 million barrels in this thing by the end of the year. So I think it's those types of things that you, when you choose the optimal comms strategy rather than the optimal policy strategy, I think that's what's especially frustrating in moments like this. And yeah, that's the main focus I would say here is that the comms have just made everyone else's jobs much, much harder. Going forward, I believe that they probably will begin to buy back more crude again if the price drops back, let's say, from 90 where it is right now, back to, let's say, you know, 80 or lower. The challenge is that what I was saying with all those congressionally mandated sales and how they got to kind of get around all of those with this big, chunky 180 million barrels in 2022. But they don't have that money anymore. That's the problem. All that money was remitted back to Congress, basically to paper over holes in the budget. You need to recapitalize the SPR account if anyone is going to refill it much more. We're already more than halfway through all of the remaining funds in the SPR account, which just, I think, will further make this really challenging politically, because, you know, congressional Republicans are going to, you know, make hay about, you know, no more SDR purchases, where I think the White House will then very rightfully be like, well, but we need more money in order to actually do that. So again, this is where, to the first point you made, that the SPR is political. And I think that's its biggest weakness. And I think if we want this, I think, really unique strategic asset to be best leveraged, both for, I think, true U.S. strategic interests, but I think more broadly market stability interests, you need to continue to erode that link with the political, because it's just going to constantly, you know, stymie any attempts to make this a real useful tool.
Between now and election day, do you think that we'll see a net build or a net drawdown on the SPR?
Between right now and then, I think we will see a net build, because I think we still have forward purchases that barrels that DOE has purchased already that aren't set for delivery until, let's say, August. Though, and again, that was part of this whole fixed forward contract purchase idea. Now, I think what you're really asking is, will we see an SPR release? You know, some kind of reason conjured up to release from the SPR in order to lower pump prices, in order to kind of juice the political prospects of Democrats in the fall. And I think someone who truly believes, I think, in the policy relevance and importance of the SPR, and I think, again, people that I have discussed this with in various organs of government, there is an earnest desire to make this a more useful tool for those goals. But everyone I speak with in the market believes that Biden will probably tap the SPR in some kind of way. And even earlier today, you had a White House spokesperson that was asked about, will the SPR be tapped in order to, you know, combat rising pump prices? And the spokesperson was essentially something like, oh, well, you know, all options are on the table and we look at everything, including the SPR, which I get as a standard kind of boilerplate political response. You don't want to limit policy optionality, et cetera, but when your major issue with the SPR is a comms problem and kind of managing expectations, I think that kind of wishy-washiness is not very helpful. I think the answer is no, we will not tap the SPR unless we have a calamitous development in the market between now and November, something like Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz. Like, that is an instance where, yes, if Iran closes the Strait of Hormuz, I think they should basically open the tap on the SPR and basically never let go. But barring something of that scale, you would need something that looked like early 2022 in order to justify anything of the scale of the intervention of early 2022. And I think at this point, both legally, the president needs a bigger reason to release that level of crude from the market, although I'm sure that lawyers can figure out ways to get it done. But I think that, you know, both legally and I think, you know, just in terms of maintaining any credibility of this tool, I don't think that they would do it. I think that, you know, for me to support an SPR release again, you would need something that looks like that. You would need, OPEC will have needed to completely erase its spare capacity, which, as we discussed earlier, seems impossible between now and November. And I think the other thing I just want to scratch on here for a second is that there are a lot of kind of progressive policy people that have seen the success, or at least perceived success, of the SPR release in 2022. And they kind of look like, wow, there's this amazing, our own little OPEC in a bottle. Look at all these things we can probably do with it. And I think that is a very, very concerning development and kind of outlook on the SPR. I think the important thing is it really is an emergency reserve. It should be used in a vanishingly few, you know, degree of cases. And I think importantly, it should only really be used if OPEC itself is in getting tapped out in some kind of way. Like, the big difference here is that the SPR is inherently limited. It's inherently finite. We know exactly how many barrels are in there. We know exactly how long it can maintain a draw of 1 million barrels a day, which is at this point just over a year. That means that you can basically replace Oman in the global crude balance for a year. You know, that's not a little. That's actually a big chunk of crude. And I think it can do a lot of good things, but it can't go toe-to-toe with Saudi Arabia. So any kind of situation that you put yourself in where you see, where again, I think this was an error for OPEC to see the SPR and the SPR release as this kind of challenge, it needs to be done in, I kind of think, a more collaborative way with awareness of the market conditions and what does and doesn't justify a release.
Rory, I want to thank you again for another terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners what services you offer at CommodityContext.com and the best ways to follow your work.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. I loved that conversation. So listeners can find all of my work at CommodityContext.com on Substack. I publish multiple pieces a week, including a weekly roundup called Oil Context Weekly. I've also recently developed an institutional advisory service if people want to reach out to me about that, if you need a fractional oil analyst in your life. And we'll also be developing some data tools along with that as well. So lots of fun stuff in the pipeline, lots of research coming down the pipe, and I hope everyone will join me on that journey.
Patrick Serezna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Great interview with Rory Johnson. Now, joining us in the postgame segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, Nick and I are recording the postgame this week, and Eric will be back to join us next week as usual. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the postgame chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button or over Rory's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, I want to start off here, Nick, by having a quick peek at the crude oil chart. And it's been actually quite a bull run all year on the upside. But this morning, we got a bit of a sell-off at the time we're recording this, and we see almost a $2+ drop in crude oil. Though it is a bit of a steep drop, the interesting thing is that we still haven't seen any real technical damage on it. A move down into this $81, $82 area so is where the 50-day moving average is, and so long as the bulls buy the dip, then we could see the bull trend resume right back up. I don't envision this spending much time below $80 on a sustained basis. And so with the sell-off already a few days in, I'm going to be looking for the buy on dip there. But let's get to talking the S&P 500, because that's where all the action is, Nick. Let's start off with actually your levels.
Yeah, Patrick. Spot price on SPX right now is approximately 50.40. We have an implied move for the May 17th monthly OPEX of plus minus 190 points. Which gives us an upper implied move of 52.30 near the highs and a lower implied move of 48.50 just above the previous all-time highs of 48.18 or so. Right now, we have key resistance at 5,100 and key support at 5,000. I'm inclined to think we see a further sell-off to the downside around that 48.50 area, because that would mark a roughly 9% decline from the high. What are your thoughts here?
Well, Nick, we've been talking for a month plus how the stock market was overdue for a correction, and here we finally have it. The selling is actually happening in an OPEX week, which typically could have seen some gamma pinning, but the selling seems pretty persistent, and we are the first time below the 50-day moving average since the November breakout. And so some sort of a correction's underway. The bigger question is, what kind of a variety of sell-off is this going to be? Is this going to be just a typical pause in the price action and a sideways consolidation, or are we going to have a much deeper mean reversion? The first hurdle in my mind is on the S&P 500 around the 5,000 mark. And this is kind of relevant because that's a 50% retracement of its year rally from January. And that will line up on page 5 and 6 with the Russell and the Dow Jones coming back to their January lows. I mean, we now are seeing the Dow Jones index being a price-weighted index. You have it trading almost back to that January low, which really just shows the magnitude of this correction. And with the Russell, again, the small caps have been lagging all year, and how quickly the sell-off ensued. A lot of the breadth indicators are already down in the 25 to 30% levels, which just continue to show that this sell-off is actually picking up a lot of downside momentum. It'll be really interesting to see whether the support lines come in right along these lows. So moving on, though, to the NASDAQ, what are the levels you're watching here?
So in queues right now, Patrick, we have a spot price of 427 approximately. We have an implied move for the May 17th monthly OPEX of plus minus 20 points, which gives us an upper implied move of 447 and a lower implied move of 407. Right now, we have key resistance above at 435 and key support below at 413. And as I mentioned in previous weeks, I'm selectively bullish on certain names, Apple and Google, while I'm bearish on the overall NASDAQ index itself. So last week, we saw Apple pop up to around 178 on news of their M4 chip. That was short-lived as it pulled back down again to lows. But Google's been performing very well. Amazon has pulled off highs, as has Meta and NVIDIA as well. So in the short term, I do think we see some declines across the board in the mega cap names. However, there are certain names that I do like. Those are Apple and Google, obviously.
All right, Nick, one of the interesting things that's been going on is obviously the substantial spike in implied volatilities. The whole year, the VIX has been trapped in that 12 to 16 handle. And finally, we're seeing elevated levels of volatility, not yet clearing into the 20 plus area, but it's been sustainably holding up here in the high teens as volatility premium is now substantially getting priced into this market. What are the levels you're watching?
So right now with the VIX at approximately 18, we can expect intraday moves top to bottom of about 1.2% roughly. And as we see volatility pick up, this makes for great premium selling way out of the money. But it's important to be very careful, obviously, because you can get burned very easily as the implied moves can be exceeded by the actual moves overall. So right now, volatility buyers have kind of caught on that insurance was cheap. And I think we're going to see perhaps a spike toward that 20 level. If we break above that, next stop, possibly 25. But moving on to page 9, we have the US dollar index, which is now making almost year highs. What are your thoughts here, Patrick?
Well, the dollar has been in a clear uptrend, but it's not just the fact that the dollar is broken out, but it's actually the cross currencies that are driving it. The US dollar index, as it is approaching this 106 to 107 overhead resistance, is really mirroring the breakdown of the euro towards the 105 level. And that's where we're seeing some of that deterioration. But really, in the macro perspective, the one thing that I think is the most relevant was the material and breakout of the US dollar yen above that 152 level. Going back even multiple years, that 152 has been a huge overhead resistance. And on page 10, I have that chart. And what we can see is that that was where the Bank of Japan was defending the currency quite consistently. And we find ourselves now distinctly breaking out with the US dollar now heading towards this 155 to 157 area, which are the first target zones above. But this is, I think, very significant because as the dollar is breaking out against this currency pair, it really can put in motion a potential risk-off impulse in the markets. The fact that this has been sustained for a week or more really means that this sell-off in risk assets broadly is not just a reaction to an overbought market, but is actually in line with a lot of the way the intermarkets behave during these risk-off cycles. Finally, Nick, I wanted to just touch on page 11, the US dollar against the Canadian dollar. And that was quite the breakout that we saw out of the consolidation. 136 was a level that I was watching quite a bit. And so with this type of a breakout, it really obviously is looking towards those October highs. But what are your thoughts in terms of how high the US CAD can go?
I mean, looking at USD CAD right now is kind of interesting, given that I'm a Canadian. Seeing the productivity disparity between the US and Canada is kind of astounding right now. And yesterday, Canada released their budget as well. I don't think that the Canadian dollar is going to see any strength anytime soon at all. US dollar, I think longer term, will head toward the $2 level against the Canadian dollar.
Well, you know what, Nick? I don't look out that far, but I'll certainly say that the trend is in favor on the short term of the US dollar continuing to rise. The bigger question, of course, will be what will happen when inevitably we start seeing economic weakness and which countries are going to be impacted the most. So it'll be really interesting to see at least whether or not this 140 level is achieved in the short term. I wanted to, though, move on to the gold chart on page 12, because what I find really interesting is that gold and the dollar have been rallying together in the last sequence. And that is not a typical intermarket relationship. Usually, when you're looking at rates and currencies, typically your gold has very clearly had an intermarket relationship. But in this circumstance, we have gold that's just marching to the beat of its own drum. And even as risk assets start to sell a little bit, gold is resiliently holding up along these all-time highs near 2,400. I still generally am looking for some sort of a pause in the advance, but I'm very bullish gold. So anytime we're going to see a $50 to $100 pullback, let's say towards 2,300, I view all of those as buy on dips that should be taken advantage of.
And moving on to the final slide, 13 here with the 10-year U.S. government bonds. What are your thoughts here, Patrick?
It's been a little bit surprising for me to see the 10-year yield rising as much as it is, but the inflation fears have certainly caused the long bonds to start to react. At this stage, with this kind of momentum, it feels that the yields can head right back toward those 5% levels where they were back in October, November. Overall, though, I view that this should become still a substantial overhead resistance. So even if we do get up another 30, 40 basis points, I do think that that resistance level will still be meaningful, especially if we do end up seeing some economic cracks start to show that could cause the Fed expectations of cutting sooner to potentially start to emerge again in these markets.
Folks, if you enjoyed Patrick's chart deck, you can find them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. Just go to the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what to expect in this week's research roundup.
Well, in this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, including a link to a number of articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's research roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.